Okay, I think that's better. Welcome, everyone. Good morning. I'm Dan Powers, a 1994 CU grad. Fortunate to be back here as a moderator for the panel today, Changing Careers, Keeping Your Options Open. We have a fantastic group of four speakers whose life experience covers quite a range of professional and career roles. So we will be hearing their insight and some advice on how to consider whatever your next steps could always be. A little homework or housekeeping that we have here. I've been asked by the Conference on World Affairs to read. In this session, we'll utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and a pencil from one of our producers. They'll come on over to you and get your question, and then they'll bring those up to me. After the initial comments from the panelists and their remarks to each other, I will be taking those questions, and we'll look to group any that are of very similar content together, but otherwise we'll go through as many of those as we can up until the session ends. So with that, let me give a brief background to the speakers you'll be hearing from. Within the printed brochure and, of course, online, you've likely read a lot of their back history, so I'm just going to pull out a few bullet points of each of the speakers to give that sense of the broad spectrum of their experience that they're going to be reflecting on. Starting with Lena Gutschenk, she was recognized with the silver medal at the European Youth Circus Festival for her partner Ariel Act at age 11, and she's since continued her work as an aerialist, dancer, contortionist, and actress throughout Europe. She's a founding member of the German Circus Research and Lobby Group, Netzwerk Circus, and is the artistic supervisor at the esteemed Palazzo Gourmet Theater in Europe. And she's performed all over the globe with those perspectives on what audiences prefer and what her own skills are addressing and developing into. Next to her, we have James Tanabe. And James is formerly the artistic director at the Cirque du Soleil, currently serving as its senior director of creative strategy. He also is a graduate of MIT and the world-renowned National Circus School of Montreal. He also has an MBA from the Wharton School with a focus on international strategy for creative industries and science background that includes research in molecular biology and neurology at the Mayo Clinic. He also has research in space plasma physics at MIT's Kavli Institute for Astrophysics and Space Research. He's a director, a writer, a performer, a choreographer, and multilingual, and his experience across the globe as well is going to inform some of his comments. Next to him, we have Ellie Schaefer. Ellie served in the White House as special assistant to former President Barack Obama and director of the White House Visitors Office in Washington, D.C. In addition to some of what you might have read about her, I found that the Capitol Hill magazine referred to her as the most powerful person in Washington that you've never heard of. Her unique mix of skills, not to mention her megawatt smile and penchant for finding the best in everyone, made her perfect for the job. And she previously, before that, ran her own business managing events for the likes of the Dalai Lama, and then also went on a small book tour with a person you may have heard of, then Senator Barack Obama. Next to her, we have Geert Verscher. I'm trying to say this with a good Dutch accent. He is a radio astronomer who's been involved in that research for over 50 years. And here locally, the connection is he was the first director of the Fisk Planetarium on CU campus. As it says, after burning out on that job, he moved on to some other interests, including the realms of esoteric claims regarding alien contact and human-dolphin communication. Most recently, he discovered a source of foreground radio emissions from the Milky Way galaxy that may yet negate the widely lauded discovery of small-scale structure in the cosmic microwave background. I'm sure you're all pondering that, over your coffee each morning. But across his experience around the world regarding the space science and other communication topics, he's published 13 books, including The Invisible Universe, and Is Anyone Out There? personal adventure in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So with that bit of background, we're going to start and go from your left to right with each of the speakers giving their comments on this topic about changing careers, and then we will get to your questions. So let's start with you, Lena.
Good morning. I feel a little bit like I'm the baby on this panel, hearing the bios getting longer and longer as we go on to the left of me. But I'm happy to see all age groups in this audience as well, so I hope it will be an interesting panel for you. I'm 32 years old, and I'm preparing to retire. Why is that? I'm a professional circus performer. Circus performers have a short career. And most of us start our training very early. I started when I was 8 years old. And most of us retire latest by their 40s. So why is that? Why do we need to prepare for retirement so early? One main reason is injury. That can have different reasons. You can get injured, you can have an accident, and you don't recover from it. This kind of stops your career immediately, in most cases. Or you can just have injuries from doing handstands for 1 trillion million times, and your shoulder just says at a certain point, "Look, I'm done. Can you please walk on your feet again?" And we're done walking on our hands. Another reason is age. I think mainly because at a certain point you start to feel most circus performers are in their 20s, and as a 35-year-old you kind of feel like, oof, I don't know if I can still like play with the kids on the one hand. On the other hand, training gets so much harder to do when you get older. With every year you need to put in like another half hour of training just to keep where you were when you were 20. I think the last reason is a little bit the fear that you have to compete with the young talent that's coming after you. So looking at all of these reasons, and everyone going into this career kind of knows these reasons, and they know that they have to stop at a certain point, but how do you prepare for this? How do you prepare for your way out of this career? So I was thinking a little bit of like what were the steps that I took in this whole process. And I feel like step one was complete denial. I was 20 years old. I just kind of started this career. I started to figure it out. I started to get bigger contracts. I was living the artist's life. I was enjoying it. And I was totally not up for thinking about how to get out of this. Step two, I think, started when I had a couple of friends who already retired from circus 2 or 3 years into their career. Reasons were they were thinking, oh, I wanted to do also something else in my life, and if I want to go back to university, I should rather do it now than when I'm 35. Other reasons were not enough job stability, not enough security. And to see some of my friends pulling out of this career so early is kind of what triggered me to think about, oh, I think I need a plan B too. I need to start to think about what I want to do after this. And I panicked a little bit, because going into this circus career was, the decision to go into it was somehow easy, because I was so certain that this is my passion. I fell in love with circus when I was 4 years old. And I just pursued this career, I pursued the training, I put all the work in that I needed to put in, and I was where I wanted to be, and it all came out of my passion. I never doubted that. And here I was, 25 years old, and feeling like I need to find a new passion. And I don't know if some of you students feel the same way now, like, what is my passion and how do I find my passion? And I found it so hard to wrap my mind around this and to go out there and seek another passion that would be just as fulfilling as the one that I've already found. So I was looking around and I was looking at what my friends did and I was reading books and I was always very interested in psychology. So I was thinking about maybe pursuing a career into this. But what made me not do it is I was passionate for that, but it never exceeded my passion for circus because it demanded of me that I stop circus right away. I felt like if I should have started this new career 3 or 4 years ago, going to university, studying, getting all of this new path. And I just didn't feel as passionate about it as I did with what I was doing right now for it to completely drop it. And I don't know how I came to it, but it took me a while to understand that I do not need to find a new passion. I just have to not look so narrowly at the passion that I'm doing right now. There's much more in the circus industry for me than just being on stage. And to realize that was like, oh, okay, I actually have the passion and I can pursue that, and I just need to understand what else am I good at in this industry and where am I needed and what do I care about in this industry other than being on stage and playing for an audience. This required me to kind of step back from circus a little bit and really just look at, okay, in general, what are the things that I care about? It's working with people, doing creative processes, like looking at just an idea in someone's head and trying to figure out the steps of how do we make this into a show? What are the steps? What are the people that need to be on the team for these things? Bringing people together for these kind of projects. And also, I needed to find out what am I good at, actually. And I was trying things out, and I felt like, oh, actually, there's a lot of things that I care about and that I tend to be good at as well. So that was something I was very lucky with. My next step was that I realized that there's definitely also things that I'm not good at. And I was trying to figure out how to gain this knowledge. So I felt like there's basic like business skills that I had no clue about. So I went out there. I took online classes from universities in business, in marketing, in finance, in leadership. I think leadership was one of the things that I've never really touched before, but that was one of the classes that formed me the most, because it was so connected to my personal life and also to my work life. So here I was. I had a rough idea that I wanted to stay in the industry. I started to gain some more knowledge of the things that I didn't have. But what is the next step? And I really didn't know how to approach this thing, because I was an acrobat, so how do I become a director or a producer? How do people know that I'm interested in this? And I think I did something that is one of the most important things in this whole process. I started to speak to people about my passion, and I started to speak to people about what I care about and what I'm interested in. And I wasn't sure if they're interested in that, but I felt that they were willing to help me. I felt that I met people that became my mentors, and I think mostly because they were once in my shoes. They were once the ones who were passionate about something and who were caring about something and who had ideas but didn't know how to start it. And they had people they went to and talked to and that helped them. And they kind of wanted to give that back. And that was something I really took so much out of. So you have people that want to help you, they push you into directions, and what happens next is there's opportunities that come up, and they're scary. When I was first approached with being the leader of an international acrobatic team of 30 acrobats from 3 different continents for production in Japan, I was so scared, and I thought, everybody else on this team is so much more experienced than I am. And I wasn't sure if I have the skill sets to pursue this and to actually make it happen. And I was really wondering if I should say yes to this, if I have to bring other people into this to help, if I should suggest someone else who has maybe a little bit more experience than that. But then I decided to just say yes and roll with it and kind of figure it out while I was doing it and seeking for help whenever I needed help and asking people to come on to the project and be part of it. And I think... this is so, just to sum it up a little bit of how I feel, like what the steps were that were important to me into changing from one career to the next. I think the first one is I asked the question, like, do I want to stay in this industry? Do I want to stay in this job? If I want to stay in the industry, do I want to stay in the same position? Or is there something else? Is there something else that I'm passionate about? Then was the phase of preparing, like get the skill sets that you need for pursuing this new career. Talk to people about what you're passionate about and talk to them about what your ideas are and what your interests are. And then say yes to opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Lena. All right, James, your thoughts.
That's very tough to follow. I'd just like to start. I like to get a sense of where people are, and I'm really excited to see such a high percentage of, I think, CU students, maybe even some students from Boulder High School in the audience. And I just want to ask two questions, and feel free to shout out answers. Don't raise your hand and wait to be called on. It's even hard to see, actually. But... they may sound stupid and they may sound naive and overly simplistic, but the first question is, why work? Why have a career? Money, skills, purpose, fulfillment, network, be valuable, contribute, impact. Sorry, two were over the same. Say again. Share our gifts. I love that. And someone in the back said one. Status, survival, self-sufficiency, I love that, identity, raise a family, couldn't hear that one, boredom, what else are we going to do on this planet? Okay, so here's my next question. Why change careers? The last one to the first one is the first of the second. Okay, interesting. Any other reasons other than boredom? Being laid off, being forced, may not be intentional. Lack of passion. Self-expression. Curiosity. Limitations. The calling aspect. Autonomy? Sure. Okay, I love that. Growth. There's a lot to unpack in that one. Oh, sorry, there were two that had felt the spirit to speak at the same time. What was it? Direction the company is going, okay. New skills. Oh, okay, I like that. These answers have a different level to them, the changing the career. Values. I'll paraphrase, earthbound motivation or passion to something more ethereal, something more universal. Keep growing, yeah. Outgrowing the old job, yeah, sure. Okay, express the creativity. I always wait for it to get a little bit uncomfortable because you never know if there's someone who has one more thing to say. But thank you for that. I want to just talk about two things, really. The first is what I learned from being in the gig economy of being a professional circus artist and then being a circus producer in Asia for about 10 years. And one thing that no one mentioned as to why have a career or why undertake a certain project, which I realized in the gig economy, is really in order to get the next one. Which is something that, as I've moved from becoming an artist, looking to get the next job, being a producer, looking to get the next project, to being someone who's dabbling in more conventional careers, either in the corporate world or in the world of finance, banking, I've kept that mentality. The idea that the reason I'm doing this career, the reason I'm doing this job or this project, is to make myself better prepared in order to get the next one. Which has been very helpful because it means that I'm not locked into one career and saying, all right, now I'm working in finance, so I'm a financier. I'm working in finance because I would like to eventually return to arts, but to add that skill set and to add that experience to what I'm able to bring to the world of the arts. So that was sort of the first point that I wanted to talk about. The rest of this is about what do we do in order to help increase our chances of being able to get that next job or to be able to step into that next career. And I think that there's really three things about this. It may sound overly simplified, but as I'm getting more and more experience and working with more and more people, I'm realizing that it's getting simpler and simpler. It's not getting more and more complex. The first one is, if you want to increase your chances of getting the next job, be the person that other people want to work with. And to really think about that. And the way I started framing this for myself is saying, who are the people I'm working with, who I really want to keep working with, and what are their behaviors, and what are their attitudes, and what are their backgrounds that make me want to work with these people, to follow them to the ends of the earth? And what can I do to try and emulate that and be that person for the people who are forced to work with me for whatever context that we're working together in? So this was a very useful framing for me. A second framing is, how do I maximize the value that I'm bringing to this project or to this team? And I realize there's two main levers. I can either be really, really good, bring a lot of content knowledge, bring a lot of expertise, a lot of experience, or I can be really, really cheap. And to realize that you should really leverage both of those levers as much as possible. If I don't have the expertise, but I really want to learn something about this project, I've realized it's okay to say, I'll do this 100% for free. And on the other hand, if I realize that this is a project that I'm really going to bring a lot to be able to articulate, if you work with me on this project, this is the value I'll be adding to it. And so I hope that you see that this is the value that you could then return to me on that, which helped me get past the artistic notion of always feeling I'm not really worth this. So there is a way to make sure that you're getting the value that you deserve without necessarily being the person that they're going to say, oh, way too expensive. We don't want to work with this person again. So that was the second piece. Find ways to add value, as much value as possible. And the third piece was very counterintuitive, which is to really challenge the status quo, if you disagree with it. I mean, don't challenge it just for the sake of challenging it. That's silly. This was probably the hardest one for me to overcome. Because I always felt that it's best to go with the flow and to say, all right, if we're going to do this bad idea, let's all do it as a team and let's make it happen. And I'll be part of that, of making this bad idea a success. But what I found is that what usually brought me into other teams or what usually brought me into other projects was that when I got so fed up and said, this is absolutely the wrong idea, we shouldn't do this, and I was so sure. And this has happened to me many times in my career. This is what gets me fired. First of all, never once was I fired for that. And the second piece is that outburst was often what one of the people in that room cited as being the reason why they wanted to bring me on to the next project that was coming up. So it was a really hard thing. I always thought I was jumping off a cliff, but it was actually the signal to people that said, I want to do things better and I want to do things differently. This, I think, is the hardest leap to take. So this is what I wanted to talk about, is just the idea of seeing the career or seeing the job that you have today as being one of the tools that you have in order to help you get to that next one. And then I just wanted to touch on these three things that I found being key to that and key to increasing your chances for that. The first being to be the person that people want to work with. The second one being finding ways to add as much value as possible, using either how much it costs to bring you on board or how much you can bring once you're on board. And then finally, challenging other people and making that leap, because that's the way that you're able to articulate that you have a different way of thinking and a different way of approaching problems. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Ellie.
Well, I'm currently unemployed, and I think the universe is telling me to run out and join the circus. So I was looking for ideas. I think, you know, for me, I'm in the process of changing careers. I was in the private sector, went into the public sector, and now going back into the private sector. My career, when I started to actually think about my career, I was a senior in high school, and which was much different than it is now. There was a lot less pressure than what kids go through today. And I went to my guidance counselor, and she said, hey, I have an aptitude test for you can take. And I was like, this is going to be amazing. And I said, I had never really thought about what I wanted to do. So somebody's going to tell me what I can do. So I filled out the questions, and, you know, they're standard, you know, do you like to work day, night, you know, just kind of a question about your personality test. So about 4 weeks later, I got a, you know, note saying, go visit your guidance counselor. She has the results of your aptitude test. And I was so excited. I remember making the long trek, you know, to her office. And I thought, am I destined to argue in front of the Supreme Court as a lawyer? Am I going to go to the moon as an astronaut? Am I going to be a doctor? You know, what is she going to tell me? I was so excited. And we sat down, and she said, you know, we got the results, and your ideal job is a flag waver for the highway department. I have to tell you, I sat there, and I was like, I did not see that coming. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Probably have better job security and make more money than I did in the public sector. But I was really kind of taken back. And I went home, and I remember I talked to my parents. And my mom looked at me, and she's like, is that what you want to do? And I was like, I don't know. And, you know, that was really the first time in my life that I remember driving home and thinking to myself, I need to define what I want to do and what's going to make me happy, and not what somebody else is going to do or thinks that I should do. And that's really when my journey started to, you know, on my professional career. I've been everything from the Hams Bear in the Colorado State Fair. I was a DJ in college. And then I started working in campaigns. And, you know, that's really where I found my passion. I started my own company. And worked in the private sector and enjoyed it. I had a blast. I had an amazing career. I had an amazing company. I was just doing great. And I met this guy, and his name was Barack Obama. And he was running, he was senator, and he had just written his second book called The Audacity of Hope. And he was doing a book tour, and I did the West Coast portion of his book tour. And, after we finished, got a call from the office, from his office, and they said, you know, he liked you, you liked him. He's thinking about running for president. You should plan on spending 2 years on the road with him. And I was like, okay. I will tell you, think long and hard about making a commitment to be 2 years on the road. But anyway, it was one of the best things that I had ever done. So I worked on the campaign, and then I went to work at the White House. And until I worked until the 20th of January. Some of the things that I think people are like, oh, you must have had an amazing career, that it's this like with no hiccups, no nothing. And I will tell you that some of my largest growth spurts in my career came from failure. And some of my advice is don't be afraid to fail. Don't make a habit of it, but don't be afraid to fail. I ran a district attorney race in San Francisco, and we lost by a narrow margin. It was one of the closest races in the history of San Francisco. And I remember just being devastated. In some ways, if you're running a political campaign, you want to, it's like a basketball game or a football game, you kind of want to blow out. When you lose by just a few votes, you anticipate and you analyze every single thing that you did. And what did you do wrong? What could you have done different? And I sat there after we had lost this district attorney's race. And I was devastated. And I was second-guessing myself. I doubted myself. I lost my self-esteem. And I went back and I analyzed every single thing that we had done on the campaign. And what could we have done different that would have won, you know, the election? And what I found is when I started to do the next race, I started thinking similar, you know, about there's no boundaries to this. We have to try everything. There is no stone unturned. What policies, you know, what we did last campaign is probably outdated. We've got to do things different. We have to do things better. And it was like really one of the biggest growth spurts for me in my professional career. And it is one of the reasons that I ended up a few years later going to work for Barack Obama. And, you know, when I was certainly at the White House, things we had a couple, you know, times where we tried things and they didn't work, but it made it better. And so I want to get to your questions, so I'm not going to bore you with a lot of stories. But I will tell you that some of the things that you've heard before, passion, things that are important to you, what drives you, what keeps you up at night, what can you live with, what can't you live without, you know, what drives you internally. You know, is really important, and don't be afraid to fail. Those are kind of some of the two big pieces of advice I have. And the other one is, you know, a phrase that my grandfather used to say, which is, if you love your job, you'll never work a day in your life. And I think those are some of the things that, you know, that are very, very important when you, you know, get into your career. So we'll get to the Q&A portion, but that's just a little bit of a little bit about me.
Thanks, Ellie. All right, Garrett.
When I look back on the various careers that I've indulged in, you might say I was lucky. And I think I was, but it's not really luck. I was open to the possibility of different things happening. And it started here in Boulder when I was at the planetarium, and I literally burned out because there was too much work, 70-hour weeks. And I quit my tenure job. It's the second tenure job I quit, by the way. And I decided to just go ahead and go through life and see what happens. So soon after I quit, I bumped into an ex-student of mine named Rory McFarland. I wouldn't be surprised if he was here. Anyway, he said to me, he's got this invention, and he started a company, and it's thanks to something he learned in my astronomy class, without which he would never have bought this particular patent. And did I want to work with him? So I said yes. So I worked with him for about a year and a half on this in this company. And I ended up becoming vice president of his little company here in Boulder. And your story reminds me. One of my jobs was to hire the sales staff for this invention that was called the anti-friction drive, which hadn't been made to work yet. And the consultants who helped us hire people had this aptitude test. And they said, would you like to take it? And I said, yeah, sure. And, you know, I majored in math and physics, and I was an astrophysicist. And the aptitude test came out, don't be a physicist, don't be a mathematician. Be a doctor or a psychiatrist or something like that. So that was an incredible insight, which came about 30 years too late for me. So anyway, I worked with Rory, but at one point I realized that his invention was not going to work because of the physics of it, because I knew enough physics and I understood the mechanism of this device. And so I resigned. So literally sitting at home here on Mapleton, thinking, what do I do next? Well, I had published two books in radio astronomy, one of them called Invisible Universe, and the fourth edition is now in Mackie. But that was 10 years before that I had published those. And I thought, well, maybe I should contact the publisher and see if they want me to do them again. So I tracked down an editor, and he said, oh, I've been trying to get a hold of you. We'd like you to do those two books again. So, wow, that's amazing. that was because I was just open to where to go wherever I could go. And I called the National Radio Astronomy Observatory director, and I said, I want to rewrite these books. Will you hire me for 6 months so I could do that? And they said, sure. So I moved to Charlottesville and rewrote these books. But in terms of career choices, I do not advise you to try and earn a living writing books. It's gotten incredibly difficult to publish books, mostly because people don't read anymore. So let's put that aside. But I have published 13 books, but I earned very little from them. So, so at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, I happened to meet my wife, my current wife, and that was 31 years ago. And she had a job, and I didn't. And so we lived wherever she lived and wherever she had a job, and I would try and get some sort of job as well, like teaching at the University of Maryland at one point when she was in Bowie, Maryland. And but before that, we lived in Tennessee, lived next to a lake. And the Lake Association fascinated me, and I met a guy who worked for a big company in Wisconsin, and he wanted to speak to a scientist about an invention he had, and he didn't understand why it wouldn't work properly. So I used my physics background and helped him. And he said, you know, we should do other things together. I said, sure. And then one night at a, I mentioned this the other day, one night at a, I think it was a Christmas party, he said, Publishers Clearinghouse is trying to figure out how they can read barcodes inside envelopes, because they spend millions of dollars a year opening envelopes to find out who the customer is and what they want. So I thought about it for literally 5 minutes, and I said, I know how we can do that. And we tested it out, and it was okay, but it wasn't a great idea. Then I got a much better idea, which turned out to be a really good patent, and I made this thing work, and I could read two barcodes inside envelopes going at 20,000 per hour past my sensors. And then Publishers Clearinghouse decided they weren't interested because they have a new business model. So that patent is now expired. But during that, I learned an awful lot about new stuff, like writing patents, which is fascinating. And we spent a lot of time literally sitting around with a patent attorney inventing stuff. Most of it had to do with electrochemical things, which we didn't understand. But this company that I was now consulting for, in order to work on this see-through project, as it was called, had other ideas. And because I was a physicist, they would ask me, how do we solve this problem? You know, we've got, this was a company that did packaging and also printing. And I found something very interesting in the corporate world, which some of you who go into the corporate world may pay attention to, that very few companies that I came across had any idea about science. They didn't have a scientist on their staff. So when I waltzed into their offices in Wisconsin, they had all sorts of things they needed to know about, but they didn't have anybody who knew anything. So I got asked these questions, difficult questions, and I found there was a pattern. So a pattern, not patent. And that was that if the question was interesting, I would have to spend time in the library, and I would discover that there were books on the subject of the question that they asked. And I came back and I said, that's a really good question. You'd have to go to university to do a PhD to answer it. Literally. I mean, it was incredibly fascinating stuff. So anyway, I was doing all of this and inventing stuff and getting patents. And the art of patent writing is really quite simple. You first have to find out what other people have done that is like your patent, and then you spend the next few weeks trying to figure out how to avoid their patent. That is mostly what it's about. How can you rewrite it so that the patent examiner doesn't realize that you're actually taking the other guy's idea and twisting it around enough so that it doesn't look the same? And that is very difficult and fascinating. And there's a whole language that they use. So there I was. There were some other things I did in my career. But to cut a long story short, my wife got job offers that she couldn't refuse, and I ended up again teaching astronomy and then doing research. And then that is the strangest experience of all, leaving the field in roughly 1973 and trying to re-enter it 12 years later. Wow, that was difficult, because so much had happened. But I did get back in, and I discovered that some colleague, former colleague, had continued an experiment that I had done. I was a pioneer in measuring the magnetic field between the stars. And he and his students had continued that and published all sorts of papers. And I looked at them, I said, I don't believe their results. So I got back into observing, found that where they had made a mistake, and started publishing papers showing that they were wrong. And from then on, I've been doing research to the point now that my wife got a job at the Large Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico, and I now have an office there, and I'm just doing radio astronomy again full time.
All right. Thank you, Garrett.
All right. I'd like to give the panelists all a chance to remark on what they just heard from each other before we get to questions. Is there anything that came to mind based on what you heard each other say?
Yes, if I may, I was just going to finish that. This point about not being afraid to fail is incredibly important. And also, when I was working here in Boulder, I came across an electronics company that made some really neat electronics devices. And if I'd been interested in changing careers, the first thing I should have done would have been to volunteer to help him and to learn. So don't turn down possible opportunities to volunteer in an area that you're not actually working in. And never say no. I know there was one other thing that I played a very important role in. When the see-through failed, I went with my friend Tom to a large manufacturer of slot machines in Reno. And this was an eye-opening experience for me because we sat around this big table with these guys who had invented a new system for putting money into slot machines, which involved paper tickets. And they had the entire system worked out, all the programs going, but nobody could make the tickets. This is the last step. So they asked my friend Tom, can your company do this? And Tom said, yes. And I knew that he had no idea whether he could or not. And that was the way to success, because then we went back, and it took us 6 months, and we figured out how to make the tickets, which are then fed into the slot machine as opposed to coins. And so never say no, but don't necessarily promise something. But he just said, yes, we can do it, and we worked really hard and made it work. So that's a part of being successful, I think, in industry, is to go ahead and try it out, but never give the impression, oh, I'm not good enough to do that, or I'm going to fail. So look at it positively.
Thank you. Others?
Yeah, it was super interesting to hear all of your stories, and I just feel like I probably have to change careers a couple more times in my life. I'm not done. But we've talked about the different things like looking for your passion and saying yes to opportunities and dealing with failure and being okay with failing. And one thing I hear mostly from hearing from the three of you is stay curious. Yes. Because I hear all of you speaking and I hear you are always open to new opportunities and also to new ideas. And I think that's hopefully something that we can all take away from this, to stay curious, no matter if you are in a job that keeps you away from anything else for 40 hours a week, but maybe there's still something that you're interested in. So maybe there's books you want to read. Maybe there's a course you want to volunteer for. All these kind of things, meeting people that do something completely different from what you do or live a completely different life from the life that you're living. And I think this staying curious is kind of what will open you up for new possibilities.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Very good.
I took four notes. I'm just going to jump through them in bullet point form from sillier to things that touched me more. The first is that what you talked about patents, of trying to change it just enough that people think it's new, reminded me of how we make shows. It's like, yes, just make it just different enough that the audience is like, wow, brand new idea.
Yes.
So that's something you can apply across fields. The other thing I realized is I have a habit at the conference, but I realize I've used it across my career, is to get in the habit of not reading people's bios. If I had known all of the details of your bios, I would have been very, very nervous just to meet you as human beings at the beginning of this. And it's just something that, I don't know, tactically it's been very helpful, just to meet people as individuals first, get interested in what they're doing, and then you read about them online later and say, wow, those people are amazing. Then there was one part that Garrett was talking about the challenges of re-entering. And Lena, you were talking a little bit about this as well. You started in this industry, you're kind of leaving into it. It's a tough thing to do because you go away from the industry changes, as Garrett mentioned, but also your point of view is changing. So things that you might have loved now frustrate you, things that frustrated you, you now understand better, and that's a very complicated dynamic to navigate. And then the other parallel that I saw between Garrett and Lena is this idea of the student or the mentor-mentee relationship, where Lena was talking about how valuable it was to have mentors in the industry that she's working in now, and Clara talking about what happens on the other end of that when someone that you have really helped form and develop actually later on becomes a collaborator in life. So it is sort of this professional dynamic that I've observed many times and just heard the echo of it here today.
Okay, well, we have several questions that have come in, and I think, as you know, we're looking to prioritize questions from students. So the first couple I'll take from that source. I think you've all touched on this a little, and it's actually a very profound and yet easy question, easy to ask. What's provided better insight during your career shifts, your head or your heart? And Ellie, you're first because...
Great. Fantastic.
Everyone else just had comments.
I will say for me, I've been guided by my heart. When I was working in San Francisco, I had an amazing career there. And when I started working for Barack Obama and was asked to join the campaign and be there for the announcement tour, which started in February of 2007, I walked away from everything I had in San Francisco to work on a campaign for this person that I so passionately believed in. And that's just who I am, you know. And so we can get into pay and, you know, and that kind of stuff. I probably cut my salary in a fourth, maybe, which was not, if I was listening to my head, I would have never done that. I walked away from a career in San Francisco where I was, you know, well known. I had established clients, established contracts, established projects, and I walked away from all of that to go on the road and live in a hotel for 2 years and, you know, bounce around from city to city and, you know, not knowing what the outcome was going to be. We didn't know if we were going to win. We thought we would, but we had no idea. So I threw caution to the wind and I just did it. And I said to myself, this is something I have to do for who I am. I so passionately believe in this. And, you know, that led to some ups and downs, you know, in 2007. You know, lots of debates. We won the Iowa caucus. We lost New Hampshire. We won Super Tuesday. You know, we lost some other states. It was this amazing, you know, emotional roller coaster.
Wow.
That your head, if you're listening to it, would have said, get off this ride. It is not safe. You are not this tall to ride this ride, you know, get off. And, you know, and I stayed there and I stayed in it and ended up working on the transition team in Chicago and then ended up moving in with the first family to what's called Blair House. Blair House is what's the president's guest house, and that's where the first family elect stays before the inauguration. And I lived with the first family in Blair House and handled their transition from private life to public life. And then started at the White House, where I stayed until the very last day, and then drove out to Andrews Air Force Base to see, you know, Barack and Michelle Obama get on Air Force One for the last time. Mm. And, you know, it was an amazing career, and if I would have followed my head, never in a million years would I have done it. Mm. Every single person that I knew was like, this is ridiculous that you're doing this. And I was like, I know. You know, I'm traveling with, you know, people who are half my age. You know, and I was like, I got to do it. You know, that's just, I just have to do it. So for me, it's a follow your heart. You can listen to your head, but you know, follow, you know, it's in the back there. But, for me, I'm a follow my heart person because that's what I am driven by.
I would say that that's a really good question, but I side with Lena. The most important thing is curiosity that drives you, which involves your heart and your head. So when I was living next to the lake, I got curious about what happens under the water. And to cut a long story short, I discovered there was something called lake science or limnology, and they had a way of measuring the transparency of the water involving a disc that you send down. And when it disappears, that's called the Secchi depth, named after Angelo Secchi, who was a Jesuit priest in the 1850s. And lake scientists had used that for 100 years, but nobody understood why it worked. But I was curious, so I started measuring Secchi depth, and I hold the world record of measuring it 542 times in one day, from sunrise to sunset. And I figured, well, I'll figure out why that varies. It took me a year. And to cut the long story short, I figured it out and wrote a paper explaining, using my astronomical background, explaining why the Secchi depth changes from sunrise to sunset. And I provided a way to normalize this, that's a technical term, so you can measure, compare Secchi depths from all over the world, no matter what latitude you're at and no matter what time of day it is. And that paper was published, and it's the only paper where the editor of the journal actually congratulated me on writing a really good paper. That never happened to me in astrophysics.
James Alina, any comment there?
And I do have a list of plenty of questions.
I just agree with what previous speakers have said.
Curiosity drives you.
Yeah, I would also say definitely for the decision, use your heart, but then please let your head play a little bit of the role when you're planning on how to pursue
Very
it.
Very good, yes.
Okay, let me build on that, either head or heart, with a couple different questions that have gotten to the gist of having perhaps someone assessing themselves and their skills and having multiple skill sets and perhaps having trouble clarifying their passion. What's the process to discover your passion?
Wow. I don't know.
I mean, I'll jump in just to start the conversation. I think that deep down you know what your passion is. Yeah. It's a matter of if you want to recognize it. There's, you know, people who are, or if you want to acknowledge it, and how long that takes. You know, you might have a passion to be a teacher, but teachers don't necessarily make a lot of money. So you're going to go into maybe a career in Wall Street, you know, and try to make some money there. Sooner or later, you find yourself kind of gravitating to your passion. It may come out in different forms, but you do find yourself gravitating, you know, towards your passion, whether it's things you do, friends, conversations you have, likes, you know, different quizzes you take, things like that. You know, what piques your interest, you know, as you're going through stuff. And so, you know, I would say pay attention to that because it starts getting you thinking about, you know, what your passion is. For me, one of the times where I had always been behind the scenes in politics, I had, and because I did campaigns, when the campaign ended, my job ended. And so working for Barack Obama was the first time I went into an administration, and I never knew that helping people would be such a passion. Knowing that you can help somebody, if I could self-sustain, that's what I do every day in my life. I'd volunteer and help people, and it is such an amazing thing that I just recently discovered within the past 10 years. Because I had never been exposed to that. But then you kind of look back on your career and you're like, well, I was doing it in just a different form. So I had been doing it my whole life. It just took a kind of a different form, you know, later when I went into the administration and worked in the public sector.
I have a quick response to that. I found that ask yourself the question, what do you volunteer for? And it's very rare that you're volunteering for something that you're not passionate about. So that's a pretty easy acid test to find out what you're passionate about.
Yeah. Okay, I have a few others that definitely build on that. How about what advice would you give to a young or old person who has no college degree but tons of real life experience and they've been denied ideal jobs and are feeling discouraged? And let me combine that with a couple others that reference, in essence, what kind of mistakes can you make, notwithstanding don't be afraid of failure. Go out there and try. But what are maybe some big things to avoid?
Well, I would advise that they volunteer and get involved through that way and discover their passion. And by volunteering, you'll be working with other people, and then you can make connections and establish networks and find the job that you want. I think it's very important to get involved in the community, no matter what you want to do.
You've all made some comments about volunteering your services, in essence, or trying something, as James described, without necessarily being paid if you knew your value wasn't to that level yet. How about build on that? A great question here from someone on, you haven't really mentioned the value of networking specifically, and what sort of tools and experiences have you had with networking to help you find that next job?
I don't have any experience in that realm. I'm too old to network. Well, that's not quite true, but I don't use computers to network, put it that way. You just have to meet people, and I really don't know how to answer that.
Well, I'm a firm believer in if you look to either side of you, there's a very good chance that these people are going to be in your lives for years to come in some way, shape, or form. And you may be shocked where you run into them. Or what they become, or, your careers may cross, you may, live in the same city, things like that. I think that, you think to yourself, geez, we have nothing in common, and then 10 years down the road, you guys are neighbors, or, you're working in a collaboration between two companies, or, something like that. I think that, the phrase, it's a small world, is true and in some ways. And I think networking and knowing people, it's that, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon type of thing. You can find somebody, you can poke around. Those people can help you. You'd be surprised at how many people want to come back and, I knew them in college. We served together. We had a project together right out of college, or we were in high school together or whatnot. I think that don't underestimate that connection that you've made in your personal life. And then in professional life, it's a similar thing. You never know where somebody's going to end up. And I think that's one of the things that to remember when you're networking. And the other thing just to touch, I know we didn't touch on the somebody asked a question about how to get a job if you don't have a degree. I think that was part of the last question. And I just want to throw out just one thing, is that getting back to the networking, never underestimate the power of personal persuasion. And a lot of times it's on an application that you have to have a degree, because that's how they separate out stuff. But use your connections. If it's really a job you want, that person is going to understand, why you didn't get the degree. Sit down and talk to them and tell them. Say, this is why I didn't finish college. This is why I didn't, do this. It is an amazing thing, the power of persuasion. I know a friend who graduated with a degree in sociology. She went to work for a nonprofit. The nonprofit got a grant from the Department of Transportation. She decided that she wanted to go and be a civil engineer. So she went to the professor in the civil engineering class, or civil engineering department, and convinced him to let her into the postgraduate civil engineering department. She had no classes, no contact with them at all. It was all sociology. And she sat down, she said, this is what I want to do, this is why it's important to me, and he let her in the program. He's like, you have to make up some math classes and things like that. She ended up being, got a PhD in civil engineering. And I think that that's one of the things that, on paper, they would have never, ever let her into the program. But the power of personal persuasion, don't let a box and checking a box limit you. If you don't have the credentials for that box, show somebody why you're still the best person for that job. Checking the box is not a reason to, if you can't check the box, is not a reason to not apply.
I just wanted to say something on networking. I think, and I'm being a bit provocative here, but don't network. I think what you should do is do interesting projects with people who are interested by those projects, and then share the results of those projects with people who are interested in the results of them. Networking, I can tell when someone's trying to network with me, and it feels very empty. But I can feel when someone's sharing a project that's super, super exciting. So networking in and of itself can be very empty. And I know what it means. There's a difference between the word and what it is. But to think about what are the projects that you do that are interesting and who else is interested in either doing them with you or hearing about them, I think is a much more productive way to think about meeting people.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to combine two here that I think might be different sides of the same coin. One is, what steps do you take to avoid unemployment / misery? But then also related, is someone who changes careers, someone who intentionally is perhaps unemployed for a short time, more human and more in touch with themselves and what they truly want in life?
Who knows?
I'm going through it right now.
Well, so, unemployment's not bad. When I quit the university, obviously I couldn't get unemployment for doing that. But when I quit the job with the that company I was working for in Boulder, I did get unemployment, but it was fine. I didn't care. And I just, you see, I retired when I was 43 years old. Retired to the point of actually drawing my retirement pension from TIAA and CREF. And that's partly helped sustain me since then. But now, of course, I have other sources of income like Social Security. But no, don't worry about that. It's just a step. Just keep open for new ideas, new possibilities, and don't say no. Say yes. Yeah.
All right. We do have a specific question for you, Ellie. What is it about politics and government that got you hooked?
You know, for me, for being hooked on politics and government, I think it was the at the beginning, it was the thrill of the campaign. It's exciting. It's a finite amount of time. You win or you lose. You know, that's pretty, you know, pretty cutthroat. And I love that. I love the strategizing and the, you know, the execution of it and molding, you know, communication. And, you know, that was just, it's fun. It's fast paced. I think when I got in and switched over to government, it's the helping people. One of my favorite days and most meaningful days when I was at the White House was we used to bring in Make-A-Wish children. And we brought in a little girl, and she met with President Obama. And after meeting with the president, you know, he said goodbye. We were in the Oval Office, and, you know, he said goodbye to her. And I walked the little girl and her dad to their car to make sure they, you know, got in safe and headed out the right gate. And her dad gave me a big hug, and he said, "You probably added a few months to my daughter's life." And I was so taken back when he said that. And it was when I had first started at the White House. And I was just frozen. And I just went back to my office. And I just, you know, tears were just streaming down my face. And to know that you can have that impact on someone is absolutely, it's the most incredible, fulfilling thing that you could, that I could possibly do. And that's what got me hooked on government. And working in the public sector. So.
All right, and there's several questions that get to almost building on how you discern your passion. Is it more important to get a college degree or some formal education or to be volunteering? And how do you decide how formal you should invest your skill building during a career change?
I think you need a college education because it gives you it gives you perspective and skills that you would not have if you didn't do that. It doesn't mean you have to use it, but as a physicist, thinking like a scientist helps in all sorts of situations. I once, this sounds very arrogant, but if you're a physicist, you can do anything. It sounds silly, but there's something about doing physics that enables you to think about the way things are in the mechanical world and so you can invent things, and it's really, it's necessary. If you don't have that background, I think it's really tough.
I guess I kind of have to disagree a little bit because I do not have a college degree. I totally understand what you're saying, and I think that skill sets like this really help you for whatever you want to pursue in your life. Just to be able to like attack a problem and know how to solve it. But I do believe that there's other ways than just the normal college to get that kind of knowledge. I know that there's online courses out there that come from very good universities that you can kind of pick and choose the topics that you're interested in and that are taught by professors from very renowned universities. I do believe that you can find people out there as well who can help you solving problems, help you get a different point of view. So I do think that college is a very good way of getting all of this in a very compact way. But I do understand someone who's 50 years old and thinks, oh, I never got a college degree. Is that something I should pursue now? I'm convinced that there's other ways of getting these kind of knowledge and these kind of skills.
Yeah. There is, in astrophysics and also in plasma physics, there are people who get really good ideas, but they don't have a degree. And they then end up having their own little conferences all talking about alternative cosmologies and plasma physics, and nobody in the mainstream listens to them. And that is a fascinating phenomenon, but I don't encourage you to enter that realm because that I've been to some of their conferences, and the people at those conferences range from highly accomplished to completely insane. I mean, that they say the most... And that is the problem when you don't have some background, because the people you're trying to convince of your great ideas do have the degrees, and it's hard to bridge that gap. That's just a fact of life.
And I think I'm a little bit in the middle. There was a time in college where I set a very low bar for success in college, and so I wasn't entirely sure that I wanted to continue. And so I went down to Mexico and became a scuba diving instructor for a while, and which was really fun, and my parents were less than thrilled. But I think that one of the things that it allowed me to do was kind of just think about what I wanted to do and what I wanted to focus on. And, you know, I don't think that it's the end of the world if you don't have a college degree, which is, I know, is horrible to say because we're here at the, you know, CU campus. But I think you can get far, but I do encourage you to keep growing, and taking classes and in your passion. I always tease my mother, who doesn't have a college degree, because she doesn't know what she wants to major in. And so she's like, well, once I decide, then I'll go back to college. And, you know, we always tease her. And she's like, well, I can't decide. And I just think it's funny. She still takes classes. When you have the continuing education, you know, your mind continues to grow and expand, and you start to see things from a different perspective. And I would say less than a college degree, continue the education. And that could be, you know, an online course. It could be a course at the library. It could be a course at the university. It could be a seminar. It can be listening to people talk, you know, things like that.
Or the Conference on World Affairs.
Conference on World Affairs. You know, to keep your mind going. So, you know, more than checking that box of actually having a degree is just keep moving forward.
Let me ask, there's also a common thread with many questions about almost notwithstanding finding your passion and making some changes, how do you stay focused on a given role when you're in it, or if you feel like you have multiple opportunities all the time and that confuses your ability to focus where you are now?
I definitely don't maintain focus at all. I believe that the right amount of time to spend on any project or any career is how long it interests you. That said, you do need to have the perspective of what is the benefit that I want to get from this experience, and how long do I need to be involved with this in order to get the result of that. So an example from my recent history was the MBA. The MBA I was interested in for about 2-3 months of the process, but I recognized that I did need to finish the full 2 years of the program in order to get the benefits that I was hoping to get out of that process. That's the only caveat. But outside of something that really kind of has a beginning and an end to be fully useful, I really don't think focus is necessarily important in the long term.
Yeah, because I'm driven by curiosity, once my curiosity is satisfied, then I'll go to another problem. And in that process, I might discover that my curiosity cannot be satisfied because I don't have the data or the technology to deal with it and go to something else. So you know, they usually run their course to a natural end, these questions you ask.
Okay, I think we probably have time for about two more here. How important is asking for help and showing vulnerability versus showing confidence, saying yes, even if you're not sure?
Yes, that's very important. My wife was the chair of the Committee on the Status of Women in Astronomy, and I know women have that, in science, have that very difficult thing about how do they get succeed and can they ask people and be vulnerable. And I think you really should ask, because the person you're asking is usually quite happy to talk about what they're doing and happy to help, to tell you what they know. So don't be afraid of doing that.
Yeah, I agree. There is, somebody else's opinion of what a project you're doing or an idea you have is just invaluable. And letting them poke holes in your theory or your process or whatnot was just, it's invaluable because it might be a different perspective that you didn't think of. And I think that it's huge. And it's also, it shows a lot about the person that you are. And it shows that you're willing to expose yourself to that person and share that with them, whether it's an idea or a paper or a job idea or a company you want to start or something like that. You know, sitting down and talking to somebody, you develop an incredible amount of trust as well. But I think it's very important to open yourself up and ask for help.
And I don't think there are many people who would reject you because you asked them for help, because people like to help.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. For me, actually, it was kind of a life-changing idea to not trying to impress people or trying to be like, I always refer to it like trying to be an adult, because I felt like I'm talking to adults who have achieved a lot of things, and I'm someone who's just learning and doesn't really know where I am. And understanding that I can like look into someone's eyes and just be authentic and just tell them what my worries are and where I am right now and what I'm looking forward to or what I would like to do and what I'm passionate about changed all of this for me. I all of a sudden had not a conversation from me to an adult, but I had a conversation between two human beings. And I experience exactly that. There's people out there that all of a sudden look at you and they understand what you're going through. They understand that you are in a process of doing something, and they're willing to help you. And for me, really, this was something that like changed my life.
Yeah. All right, a final question. Try to answer this in 30 seconds, but it was very provocative. How does a new vocation help you find yourself?
Oh, whoa.
And you can continue that in the informal section afterwards. But.
I mean, I'll jump in, and I think that, you know, when you start something new, you challenge yourself, and you are pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, and that forces you to reexamine everything that you believed about yourself or your career or your job or what you stood for. And you know, there's a whole new set of rules, whole new set of players, you know, whatnot. And it really forces you to grow. But boy, you know, when you get shoved out of your comfort zone when you start a new job, that, you know, it forces you to grow, and it forces you to reexamine what you believe in and you know, what you're good at, and excel in those things no matter what the situation is.
This panel has made me realize that I've had a really interesting life. And sometimes I feel terribly negative about my existence and I think I'm a failure. Literally, I mean, even a few months ago. But this perspective I've gotten today is, wow, I have been very fortunate, and I shouldn't look on the dark side of anything. It's just incredible that I've... Anyway, that's been a very positive experience for me today.
That's one of the best things I've ever heard here at the CWA. James Olina, 30 seconds on finding yourself?
I'll do it in 10. I just think that the first week of trying to pick up a new skill is when you learn the most, because you're in that beginner mind and everything is new and it's really exciting. That for me is the exploration part.
You have the final word, Lena.
Yeah, for me it starts even earlier than that, I think. It's deciding to jump into the new thing. And that just starts the whole process of you learning new things and you discovering new things about yourself. And I think it's that making that decision to jump into it and to just try it and say yes, that is what teaches you the most about yourself, I find.
Great. Please join me in thanking our panel.